Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast. I'm Michael Serapio in front of St. Patrick's Basilica in Montreal, and this is where Canadians are taking one final moment to say goodbye and pay their respects to Brian Mulroney. Coming up, we will talk about the political legacy the late Prime Minister leaves behind.
And I'm Andrew Thompson in Ottawa with our journalist panel looking back at the week on Parliament Hill and what's to come after contentious debates on carbon pricing and the Middle East. This is Primetime Politics. And you'll see that discussion with journalists a little later on our program. First, let's go to Montreal and join Michael Serapio ahead of tomorrow's state funeral for Brian Mulroney. Michael.
Andrew, you are looking at St. Patrick's Basilica in downtown Montreal. Now, this is the oldest English Roman Catholic church in Quebec, and for nearly two centuries, it has played large roles in the lives of Irish Catholics, not only here in Montreal, but throughout Canada as well. And this week, it's also playing a role in history, because this is the sacred space where Mr. Mulroney's body is currently lying in repose, and this is where it will stay until early tomorrow morning, when the funeral cortege will take the casket from St. Patrick's and bring it to Notre Dame Basilica in Old Montreal. Until then, this is where Canadians from all walks of life have been gathering to pay their final and last respects to the late Prime Minister.
I think it's one of the greatest Prime Minister we've had. Yeah.
How so?
I think he was really working hard to unify the country at a time where it wasn't obvious. People don't realize, but with his work on NAFTA, he created a lot of economic opportunity for the country. So you take care of people's well-being, wealth, opportunity to grow, and you try to unify. What else do you want from a prime minister?
He's exceptional. There is in the world we live right now, I think what he did for all our country and for the world, I think nobody else has done that yet.
So I want to pay tribute to a man of dignity. I really enjoy what he's done on the international field. We are not on the same party, of course, but he was always there for me. He was very supportive when I was mayor of Montreal, and we shared a lot together. So what I'm proud of is I told him what I thought when he was alive instead of now.
Well, it's very important to come out and pay tribute to Brian Mulroney, a transformation leader for the country. I'm from Nova Scotia, and he's been a great supporter of our province and our region. Has made a big difference with the Brian Mulroney Institute of Government. And it's important to say thank you for his service. It's important to show to his family that we are there for them. The loss of a great Canadian, a great Prime Minister, a great Conservative, but also a father and a husband and a grandfather.
Well, we're now joined by John Parisella. He is the former chief of staff to the former Quebec Premier, Robert Bourassa, at the time when Brian Mulroney was Prime Minister. You know, John, so much has already been shared by many Quebecers about Brian Mulroney. But from someone who had a front row seat to all of this history, how important was Brian Mulroney to Quebec and to Canada?
I think he's one of the most significant prime ministers for Quebec. He took over after the breakdown on the constitutional talks that occurred, and Quebec did not sign on to the 1982 constitution. So he tried to reconciliate, which ended up with Meech Lake, which didn't pass. And then we went to the next phase of Charlottetown. That also didn't pass. But Brian Mulroney was a real strong ally of reconciling Quebec with the rest of the country. So in many ways, as Canadian Prime Minister, he essentially saw Canada through the eyes of a Quebecer. He understood the need for reconciliation. So I saw a man who had vision. I saw a man who had courage, and I saw a man who had resilience and a person who never gave up. So as much as he did a lot of important things, fighting apartheid, getting free trade, and opening the door to the acid rain deal, for Quebec, he remains a person that tried to really make it work, make our federation work.
And I think you get a sense of that because ever since his death was announced, just about every political program in the province, popular programs, they are talking about the contribution and just how important Brian Mulroney was to Quebec. How well-loved is he in the province, would you say?
I think he's well-loved, well-respected. The human side of Brian Mulroney is seen by so many people who have either connected with him or he stayed in touch with. His family is very central to who he is as a person. So I think to a lot of Quebecers, he's seen very much with that human touch. But from the point of view of a prime minister who had courage to make change, he's also seen as a guy who was not afraid to make change and not always popular in the process of making change. So he's seen as a man of vision and a man of courage as well.
You say not necessarily popular as one is making change, and there is this real sense of that, because I remember certainly being very young, watching all of this unfold at the time, and a lot of people were very critical of Brian Mulroney. A lot of people were not happy with his constitutional stance, but when you look at where we stand right now as a country, his legacy is there.
Oh, very much so. You know, when you you take a stand, sometimes you'll have people who will be with you and people who will be against you. So obviously on free trade it was not unanimous, but he won the battle. On the question of reconciliation with Quebec, again, there was a division, and we saw how Meech nearly made it across the finish line, didn't. And Charlottetown, at the same time, we had a similar type of situation. So he was that kind of a person who didn't do things because they were popular. I think now we look back, especially on his role regarding apartheid, as being very significant and being actually quite novel for the rest of the world. He took on Reagan, he took on Thatcher, and he wasn't afraid to stand up to them. But for him, the most important relationship for a Canadian prime minister was getting along with the U.S. president, to defend our interests and to have influence in the rest of the world. Because if the rest of the world looks at Canada and they say the Canadian Prime Minister can talk to the U.S. President, it gives us more strength.
Well, I know you wrote about that for La Presse earlier today, but even in that time when one talks about the criticism that Brian Mulroney took in his era, he was criticized for being too American, too close to the United States. But build on what you just said right now, just how actually important that was for the type of country we are now.
Well, the biggest partner, economically speaking, is with the United States. We're allies, we're partners, we're friends, and we're neighbors. So that relationship's important, and I think whoever wins the election in the United States next November, the Canadian Prime Minister has to have a dialogue, has to have connections. And it can't just only be between the personalities. It has to be diplomatic way as well, through the embassies, through the councils, through the Quebec Delegate General in particular, who serve in the United States. There's 10 offices. So it's very important to keep a dialogue. And yes, people who wanted to be critical about Mr. Mulroney, they said he was too close to the United States, but he stood up to Ronald Reagan on apartheid. He stood up to Ronald Reagan on some last-minute changes to the free trade agreement, and he was able to bring the free trade agreement, including Mexico, across the finish line as well. It was signed ultimately by Mr. Chrétien and Mr. Clinton, but 90% of the work was done by Brian Mulroney and George H.W. Bush.
Mm-hmm. You bring the politics of then to the politics of now, and that makes me wonder about what lessons do you think current politicians can learn from Brian Mulroney?
Dialogue, never treating your adversary as an enemy, and trying to find ways of finding solutions to problems. And sometimes you can't win it all, sometimes you have to lose a bit, you have to pull back, but he was always ready to extend the hand, and I think he'll be remembered very much for that.
John Parasella, always appreciate our conversations. Thank you.
It's a pleasure, Michael. All of us.
And that was John Parasella in conversation with Michael Serapio outside St. Patrick's Basilica. Inside today, the Mulroney family continuing to receive condolences and also taking a few moments together on their own.
Yes, she wasn't born. It's all for fun. I'm over double.
And on Saturday, the funeral procession will make its way from St. Patrick's to Montreal's Notre Dame Basilica, where Brian Mulroney's state funeral will take place. CPAC will broadcast the ceremony on our channel and online at cpac.ca. Time now for a look at what happened in politics this week. The public inquiry on foreign interference says its hearings will resume in Ottawa next week. The commission is looking at allegations that foreign powers meddled in Canada's last two federal elections. More than 40 witnesses are expected to testify over 2 weeks. The list includes current and former senior government officials, political party representatives, federal cabinet ministers, and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Those hearings start next Wednesday. On Monday night, MPs passed a motion on the Middle East after some late amendments. It did not recognize a Palestinian state. However, the largely symbolic vote did urge Canada to actively pursue the establishment of one as part of an eventual two-state solution. The NDP tabled the initial motion, and the vast majority of Liberals voted in favor after changes that included a condemnation of Hamas and new language on arms sales to Israel.
We have forced this government to move in a certain direction. Now, this is what they're agreeing to do. We are now going to pay close attention that they actually follow through on these things. But what we have forced the government to is to move substantially, to take concrete steps that will improve the lives of people on the ground right now, to save lives. We have got them to agree to do these things. Now it remains to be seen if they will do it or not. But this is something that we can be very confident that we've pushed the government to do something they would have not otherwise done.
And finally, the official opposition hammered the governing Liberals in Parliament over the carbon tax this week. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre introduced an opposition motion on Thursday, forcing a confidence vote in the Trudeau government.
We cannot, in good conscience, stand by while this Prime Minister imposes more misery and suffering on the Canadian people. We, as common sense Conservatives, are ready to restore hope in this country, but it starts with change. We rise today to vote non-confidence in this NDP Liberal government and to restore the great country that we love based on the common sense of the common people united for our common home.
That motion failed in the House of Commons 204 to 116. But the debate about the federal carbon levy continues. Conservatives want to stop the upcoming April 1st increase. Liberals say Conservatives want to end the carbon rebate that goes back to many Canadians. All right, well, let's bring in our journalist panel to talk about the week that was on Parliament Hill. Robert Fife is Ottawa Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. Laura Osman is a reporter with the Canadian Press. And Joelle Denis Bellavance is Ottawa Bureau Chief for La Presse. Good to see all of you.
Thanks for having us.
So we have these two opposition motions that were really driving the debate this week on Parliament Hill. And I want to start with that motion on carbon pricing. Laura, at the end of the day, that Conservative motion did not pass. As expected, we didn't really think that we were going to be heading into an election this spring, and we still have the Prime Minister and the Environment Minister really telling Canadians, look, this is going to happen. This carbon price increase is happening on April 1st. We are not changing course. So what do you think the Conservatives got out of this debate this week?
So the Conservatives never thought that they were going to be able to bring down the government this week. That wasn't their intention. In fact, they were counting on the fact that other parties were going to impose them. That's because they want to send the message to Canadians that they're willing to go to battle over this issue, that this is the number one thing that they care about because they believe it's the number one thing Canadians care about. It's become a symbol for the affordability crisis in Canada. They wanted to send a message that they are going to do everything in their power as an opposition party to try to address this, you know, this hike. They want to spike the hike. They want to axe the tax, and they're willing to do whatever it takes to do it. And if people really want it done, clearly the other opposition parties are not going to be on board. The Conservatives are the only option. And so as government, that's the only way that it's going to happen.
And it was a message that Pierre Poilievre was really hammering home all week, especially on Wednesday in question period, going up against the Prime Minister, JD. And, you know, the answer back from the Prime Minister and other Liberals has been twofold. Number one, the Conservatives don't have a plan for climate change. And number two, they want to take away the carbon rebate, which they have, of course, rebranded. So what do you think of the Liberal messaging this week, and is it going to be resonating in the weeks to come?
I don't think so, because the Liberals' message is more complicated to understand than the Tories' message. The message from the Tories is very simple. Tax the tax, everybody understands that. Whereas when you go into the Liberals' messaging, it's more complicated because you say you pay a tax, but you get a rebate, and it favors 8 out of 10 families in Canada. So on that front, the Liberals are more on the defensive. But I'd like to go back to what the Tories were trying to achieve. I think they want to make sure that everybody perceived the other parties in the same manner, favorable to a tax. And I think it's sort of a rehearsal for the Conservative. And I wouldn't be surprised if they come back again with a motion to defeat the government in the coming months, because they're driving for an election. They want an election right now because the polls are very favorable. And also, I think it's good theater also in the House of Commons. It's good to raise money for the Conservative Party, whereas the coffers is already full of money and they have want more to spend more on maybe probably advertising and getting ready for the federal election when it comes.
Yeah, and Bob, what do you think about the maneuvering between the parties this week on this? It is interesting that there is this element now of provincial politics coming into the debate, not just from premiers, but Conservatives making hay of the fact that, look, it's not just provincial Conservatives pushing back, it's Liberals and New Democrats in provincial parties in opposition across the country. So what do you make of the communication challenges and the policy here?
Well, you know, the Liberals shot themselves in the foot when they exempted home heating fuel in Atlantic provinces for purely political reasons to help their base in Atlantic Canada. Now, yes, they've now extended home heating fuel across the country, but the fact of the matter is most people, it's natural gas, and they're still having to pay a tax on that. So they've hurt themselves. Their credibility has been shot by this. Mr. Polyev, because we're in inflationary times and the cost of living has gone up considerably, he's been able to really use this very, very effectively. So people are saying, hey, I don't want to have this big increase that's going to affect my groceries or my heating bills or whatever. Even though he doesn't say this, but 80% of that money is rebated back. But the Liberals have been very ineffective in dealing with this, and I don't know whether they can. I don't know how they're going to be able to succeed in beating Mr. Polyev on this front, except that they are quite legitimately right in saying, where's your plan, Mr. Polyev? Because he doesn't have one.
Okay, let's go to another opposition motion that's been continuing to reverberate throughout the week, and that is Monday's motion from the NDP on the Middle East. This was an emotional debate, Bob, that turned confusing for a lot of MPs on Monday evening. We had an NDP motion amended at the last minute with Liberal amendments, and it did pass, but we did have three Liberals notably voting against, including Anthony Housefather, who's now saying that he feels isolated in the party, that he feels that some Liberals crossed the line by supporting the NDP's position. He's reflecting on his role in the party. What do you think this all means? Do you think there's an actual chance that Mr. Housefather could leave the Liberal caucus?
Look, he's been very uncomfortable since October 7th and the reaction amongst many people to what has been happening in Gaza. And let's face it, there has been a rise in anti-Semitism. We know that as a result of this. Not to say that we shouldn't care about what's happening to the poor people in Gaza. I mean, this is a terrible situation that they're going through. But I don't think he's going to quit. He was unhappy a couple of months ago on the very same subject, and then they made him a parliamentary secretary, and he seemed to quiet down. Let's see if he goes anywhere. He wouldn't find a home really in the Conservative Party. I mean, I just can't see him sitting in that party. So I don't think he's going to go. But if he does go, it's not good for the Liberals. And you know, it's again this government in their ninth year, tired. And when you start to split, and people start splitting, as we saw on Monday, with a good number of Liberal MPs willing to support the original NDP motion, It's difficult. It's not a good moment for the Liberals, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. And I don't even know why they got themselves involved in all of this to begin with. They should have said, we're going to vote against the NDP motion.
Yeah, Laura, what stands out for you in how these talks unfolded between the Liberals and the NDP on what is today actually the second anniversary of the Liberal-NDP confidence and supply agreement?
You know, I think that it's possible that one of the motivations for the Liberals working so hard to try to find a way to support that motion by bringing forward these amendments in the 11th hour, 7 p.m. after a very long and emotional debate, was that it was going to appear as though the split in the party was even greater if they had voted against it, because so many Liberal MPs had come forward to say they wanted to support the original NDP motion, that they felt morally compelled to do so. And I think, you know, this debate, the tension between, you know, the Palestinian plight and the Palestinian right to, you know, self-determination and Israel's right to defend itself, has been playing out all over the country for months now. It's created fissures in institutions across the country. It's created fissures in friends groups and families across the country. It's no surprise that it's also happening in the Liberal Party, where there's a diversity of views. It's one of the most divisive issues in the world right now. But I think that the Liberals have been trying to walk this line where they keep everyone happy. And as a result, they have made the two opposing views in their party unhappy. And people have been frustrated by that. And I think that's why people wanted to support the NDP motion in the first place. And I think that's why Anthony Housefather felt rather betrayed when the government at the last minute changed their position.
JD, where do you think this goes from here now? Because obviously, you know, Israel, Hamas, Gaza, the story isn't going away. That conflict isn't going away, especially when MPs come back 2 weeks from now. This is still likely to be front and center.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good question. And there's some confusion about what some of the clauses in the motion actually mean. Namely, what does it mean when Canada says we're not going to export military arms to Israel? Is it an embargo? Some say, yes, it is an embargo. Some say, no, it's not an embargo. So even after this was voted on in the Liberal caucus, there seems to be division about what it actually means. And I think this issue will remain divisive in the Liberal Party for the foreseeable future for the following reason. I talked to some Liberal MPs yesterday about this, and they said that Mélanie Joly, the cabinet minister, was negotiating for the government with the NDP, spent more time talking to the NDP than to the Liberal caucus. So they're angry with that minister about her failing to consult properly the Liberal caucus on why the government introduced those amendments to the NDP motion. So it will leave traces of division for the foreseeable future. And I think the Liberals, I think, having some trouble with the kind of relationship it had built with the Jewish community in Canada. Now it has some, I think, accountability to give to the community as we move on.
Okay, we have a few minutes left, and I want to talk about another story that's continuing to percolate on Parliament Hill. That is federal contracting and procurement. JD, your newspaper has been doing a lot of reporting on this, and we had the government come out and announce this week that they've done this internal audit. They've found $5 million in false bidding with three subcontractors, and they're saying, look, there's more to come. We're doing more of these investigations. So how bad do you think it's going to get?
I think they probably broke the story before either the Globe or La Presse broke that story, because the Globe and Mail has been breaking a lot of story on this as well. So I think they wanted to go ahead of the curve, so if there was any damage, they would be seen as doing something about it. But it's quite revealing that this is a problematic issue for the government in terms of procurement. We've seen it in the military. Buying military equipment is problematic. Now, buying simple things has become problematic for the government. So, and people understand the little value, you know, if they can understand what it means, 1 million, 2 million. So this is very problematic for the government, and they wanted to go ahead. And I was told that they're using artificial intelligence now to collect data and to make sure that if there is, you know, by crisscrossing data, they can take out the bad apples that way. So that's a new phenomenon that is being used by the government to try to root out any corruption, a new development also on that front.
Yeah, and Bob, as well on this story this week, some pretty interesting and conflicting testimony that we had at Committee on National Defense from senior officials and one of those contractors under scrutiny, seemingly at odds about whether there's a conflict of interest at play in that story. So
it's ridiculous.
Tell us, what does this mean?
Is, he's got a multi-million dollar company that he's getting millions and millions of dollars from the Canadian government, and then he goes to work as a regular $80,000 a year employee at the National Defense Department, doesn't tell anybody, apparently, doesn't tell anybody that he's doing this. Clearly, Bill Matthews, who is the deputy minister at National Defense, is saying that there is a lot more to this story than we currently know. The RCMP have been called in. But I think actually there's one bad apple, but I think that we're just scratching the surface. I think there is a lot more of this going on. And the only good thing that's going to come from this, hopefully, is that we'll have proper measures in place to make sure this doesn't happen again. But I don't think this is going to be the end of it.
Okay, Laura, very quick last word to you on that. On these measures that Bob's talking about, we had ministers come out and say that they've got this suite of new measures to try and put a stop to some of these practices. Do you think that's going to be good enough to weather the political storm that the government is still under?
I mean, politically speaking, no. Practically speaking, to stop bad contracting actors, probably not. You know, I think that this is a massive problem that most likely has been going on for decades, to be fair to the Liberals. But, you know, their information systems are so out of date that one contractor can bill two departments for the same work and be paid twice. You know, that's a problem. So they really need to make investments to stop this. Politically speaking, though, even though this had nothing to do with ArriveCan, it has everything to do with ArriveCan. And, you know, the same issues cropping up over and over again start to smack of incompetence, and that starts to tell a story that's going to stick with the Liberals.
All right, we have to leave it there. Thanks to all three of you for this. And that is our program for this Friday, March 22nd. I'm Andrew Thompson in Ottawa. We hope you'll join us tomorrow for our special coverage of the state funeral for Brian Mulroney, hosted by Michael Srapio and Esther Bergin live from Montreal. That gets underway at 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 Pacific. Until then, for everyone here at CPAC, thanks for watching and good night.